Welcome to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight, the podcast where we uncover the secrets of CEOs, entrepreneurs, and visionaries who've used public speaking to skyrocket their businesses and their bottom line. Get ready for captivating stories, valuable insights, and practical wisdom from the trailblazers who've mastered the art of the stage. I'm your host, Kelly O'Hara, and I'm thrilled to bring you their experiences and expertise directly to you. Let's get started. Welcome back to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight, the show where we pull back the curtain on how public speaking isn't just a skill, it's your business accelerator, your brand builder, and authority amplifier all rolled into one. I'm Kelly O'Hara, and today we're diving into the world of podcasting, not just any podcasting, but the kind that's built for the legal pros who are ready to ditch the boring blog posts and step into real visibility. If you've ever wondered how lawyers can go from just another firm to being the voice people turn to in their market, this show's for you. My guest today is Dennis Metter, CEO and founder of the Legal Podcast Network, and the guy who's flipping the script on how attorneys market themselves in the modern age. With over two decades of experience helping legal professionals grow their practices, Dennis doesn't just stumble into the space, he's been building businesses since he was 14. His latest venture, a done-for-you podcasting platform designed specifically for attorneys who want to build authority and reach their ideal clients and do it without drowning in all the tech headaches. He's part marketing wizard, he's part storyteller, he's part barbecue master as well, and he's here to show us how combining legal expertise with the right messaging and a mic can create a ripple effect that extends far beyond the courtroom. So whether you're a legal pro looking to finally get your message out, or a business owner curious about how podcasting can help establish serious credibility, this conversation is really going to spark some big ideas. So let's get into it. Welcome to the Spotlight, Dennis Metter.
Good to be here. We've already had a wonderful conversation, so hopefully it's all uphill from here because we've had a great conversation. So let's not go downwards. Let's just keep accelerating this thing up.
I love it. And I did touch on in your intro, you've been building businesses literally since you were 14. You started early, but what I loved about it is that you talk about selling things like snow shoveling and lawn mowing and paper routes, but your team was doing the work. What was the moment that you realized you're not going to be following a traditional path?
I've always known I'm a little bit different. Like I grew up in church, like we grew up like my friends were seniors in high school and kindergartners and grandmas and parents. I grew up in that sort of like mind frame of let's not separate the kids out and they only have kids that are in their peer group. And so I've always had no problems talking to adults, talking to older kids, and just talking to pretty much anybody. And that served me well. I started really at about 8 years old finding a way to make money because we were in a very bad situation. My mom, she just didn't choose the right guys to date, heroin dealers, crack dealers, gang leaders. So our house was like a gang house. So we had big, huge parties every night. We'd have 200-300 cans each night piled up in our house. Me and my sister would bag them up, take them. We would eat through the day off of that. And so I learned at 8 years old, Friday night, I'd see money in my mom's purse from her job at the time. That's before she really got into the street life. And I would steal out everything but $100 and hide it away. And then on Monday, be like, oh yeah, I found this. I think it's for the electricity. So I learned to be conscious of money at a very young age. And then going into realizing like more money can be made from facilitating than in doing the act was really when I went with my brother and his best friend the first time. We were knocking doors one after the other. I think we had been at it an hour or two. We were cold. We had made maybe $15 a piece and we were thinking we were going to make 100 more or more. And my brother's friend was like, I don't want to knock on the door because all three jobs I had gotten. And I learned enough about candy sales at school and all. You have to have a little story. So I'd go up, I'd say, hey, me and my brothers are out. We're shoveling walks. I'm the oldest of six kids. We use this to supplement so that we can buy school clothes and school supplies. And so if we can mow your lawn, and people be like, oh yeah, great. Because if you just go, hey, you want me to mow your lawn? They're just like, ah, some spoiled kid trying to get 20 bucks from me. But I always had, and it was true. I wasn't like I made up the story. That was a true story. And I would share that story with them and convert higher. And then I remember I went up to the lady because my brother and his friend didn't want to knock their turn. So I actually went up, knocked on the door. The lady handed me $20. I took $10, put it in my pocket, handed $5 to my brother, $5 to his best friend. And I said, guys, I got a great idea. Instead of us switching and you guys getting frustrated about and having to knock on doors, I'm going to keep knocking on doors. You guys stay here and shovel this walk. By the time you get done, I'll have another job for you to go to. And I started doing it every 3-4 doors down. And then I would write down everybody. And next time it snowed, we would just go on our route. And it was a lot quicker. Then spring came and we started lawn mowing. And I started going to the houses, getting the jobs, giving them to my brother and his friends. And then the fall came and then it was paper routes and the same thing. And so I was the face. I would go and I would get the jobs. I would collect the money and I would pay the people. And then all of the people that worked with me would go do the jobs. And that's when I learned, hey, there's a lot more money in facilitating and making things happen than in actually doing things. Because my brother's friends were happy to make $5 to mow a lawn for 20 minutes. And here I am making $10 for walking up the door for three. But had I not walked up to the door for three, they never would have had the 10 minutes of work to do or 20 minutes of work to do. So that's how I looked at it.
This is beautiful. You literally are born business. So it sounds like you completely brought yourself up and learned the values that an entrepreneur has to have. And you already had a built-in crew. You had a built-in workforce.
Yeah, I did. And that's the thing. I didn't think about it. To me, I was just like, my parents put us in a private school with people with money. My mom would go watch kids in the morning so we could go. And it was like the kids had Jordans and Bugle Boys and all of that. And it was like we were getting clothes out of the clothes pantry at the church and baskets of food from the clothes pantry at church. So how did I compete with that? So I went and made my money so I could keep my hair cut. I made money so I could keep nice clothes. I made money so I could buy the Jordans and be on the team. I made money so that I had money when I went on the team outings. I paid all my own fees for my teams. I paid all my own fees for traveling choir. I paid all my own fees when I was out doing stuff. I had my own money because my parents were like, we've got six kids. If we keep you alive, that's enough. And so from there, I'm Gen X, so they're a boomer, right? So like to them, they're like, you're not going through a war. Just be happy. Just live your life. And if you want more, you go get it. And so I took that to heart. I wanted more and I went and got it.
I think those are such good messaging that your parents gave you. I can even remember, that makes me think of my mom at one point. I felt like we were very blessed, but we had some wonderful things happen for us. But I remember at 18, my mom said, okay, here you go. I've shown you the best that life has to offer. You have been given many privileges and blessings. And now it is up to you to go create that for yourself. It is now your turn. And I'm assuming you're the oldest. I'm the oldest in my family as well. Not of six kids, but there were four of us. And I remember thinking, wow, okay, it just seemed like the right rite of passage. Okay, I go get it for myself.
It didn't seem strange to me. I turned 18 on Wednesday. I graduated high school on Friday. And on Sunday, I was at an unaccredited Bible Institute in the middle of the Ohio, West Virginia Valley, and $20 in my pocket and a start to life. And it was just like, and then I got married. So I pastored a church at 18. I got married at 19. I had my first LLC at 20. At 16, I stopped dating girls that I wouldn't eventually marry. So I was like the youngest old man on the planet. Never took a drink of alcohol till I was 36. Like I was very serious about church and life. And to me, it didn't make sense. I had my own businesses. I had one business I started about 2021. I retired for 3 or 4 years where I would run it like a couple hours a day from Romania, which is where my ex-wife was from. And so like, to me, it was just like, this is just life. Like I worked from the time I was 18 to the time I was 36, almost 18 years. I worked 18, 20 hour days almost every day because to me, I was like, I'm young. I want to monetize every moment. That was my internal thing to say to myself, monetize every moment. So if I'm sitting down with the family, it's because I'm trying to get them into church. If I'm sitting down relaxing, I'm watching a documentary to teach me something about something I want to learn for teaching. Like, I didn't allow moments to just be moments. There had to be a monetization purpose behind them, whether now or in the future.
How did this work with the spouse you chose? With someone that is that driven, and obviously it's great when you have a partner who gets it and is able to monetize what they do so well. But what was your decision-making process in choosing the woman that you did, and how she played into this? Because a partnership, that's the most important partnership you have.
So we're not together anymore. So I'll put that little precursor. We were married 21 years. We got married at 19 and we divorced when I was 40.
A good run.
When we first got married, 19 years old, she was really like, wow, like he's driven. He's going to take care of this. And I haven't, since I was like 18, I don't think I've made less than $75,000 a year. Most years, 100, 200, 300, 400 grand. Like that, I've been an earner. However, whatever I did, whether it was my own business or working for other people. But the problem that arose over time is that she grew up in communism and I was an entrepreneur. Communism says, I would rather have $500 every Friday for the rest of my life. An entrepreneur says, give me $10,000 this week and nothing next week, because that equals 10 times more than I would have gotten.
Sure.
But for her, it was very hard, the up and down, for me to be like, oh yeah, we got $30,000 in the bank. Let's take care of all of this. And then 4 days later, be like, okay, what are we doing? And be like, we just spent all that. So we got to wait for more money to come in and we got to move things around. And so I think that created a friction, especially when my first business partner ripped me off for millions of dollars, product I had created, staff I had trained, basically took a company from me and him in an office. A year later, we were doing $3 million with a net 25 profit margin. We had about 50 employees. I came up with this. It was called a just-in-case emergency guide, 6x9 magnet, poison control, animal control, on-call nurse at the hospital, emergency power outage. And then we did 2x2 squares, mortgage agent, insurance agent, real estate agent, lawyer, body shop. And we would just sell those little ads around for $500. So we were running like an 80% profit margin before paying all of our people and everything. He came in. That happened, and then it hit me pretty hard because I was also a pastor in North Tulsa, and my sister, my brother-in-law, my cousin, some close friends had moved to Tulsa to work for me, plus a lot of people that were in my church that I was pastoring were working for me. And so when my business partner basically said that I had broken our non-compete, then, and I went and got an attorney, but then like, it cut off $5,000 a week to put into my business. So I was trying to keep payroll up, but I had 20 people working for me and I couldn't pay all their payroll by myself. And so I had to start letting off people going. And what was hard about that, I'm like 25. I had people like 2 weeks ago telling me I'm the savior of their life. And now they're like, you're the biggest crook in the world. Like people that just turn on you through situations like that. And so it was a good 8 to 10 years before I did anything besides consulting. Like I did a lot of consulting jobs with one VA where I was my own company, but I was really fearful of actually hiring new people and bringing them in because of that trauma that had happened to me in my mid-20s. And I probably wasn't like emotionally ready for something like that, but I didn't think about it. I didn't think of failure. Failure wasn't an option. So I never considered, what are you going to do if you have to let all these people go? And so when that happened, that was about 10 years into our marriage, that kind of changed the dynamic where we struggled a lot in our relationship. And then the last few years, especially, we have a daughter who's bipolar one. And so we were trying to keep her in and out of like situations, police and threatening suicide, threatening killing other people, being in programs, fighting, hurting people at school, like a lot of very dangerous behavior. And so the last 4 or 5 years, on top of the fact that she couldn't understand the mind frame and the lifestyle of an entrepreneur, because the average successful entrepreneur has 5 failed businesses and 2.5 bankruptcies. They're 50 something years old. Like most people think a success story is like a 25-year-old kid. That is such an outlier. like in the 90th percentile, people who become first generation millionaires do it after failing several businesses, having a couple of bankruptcies. And then when they're in their late 40s, early 50s, they finally hit their stride and it all comes together. But she didn't understand that. So we just parted ways. My oldest two were graduating high school. And I just went to her and I said, I'm not willing to go into this next phase of my life with what we've had the last 10 years. So now I'm very fortunate. I just got remarried about a year ago, actually a year ago yesterday, 420. And she is super supportive, super like when my partner broke up with me December, it was 4 months away from our wedding. And she was, I was just like, listen, I'll have a new business up in no time at all. We'll start getting this thing going. And she's okay. I trust you. Like, you know what you're doing. And she just got out of the way. And then now here we are a year later, I've got 125 clients. I've got 30 employees and we started from scratch. And it was just having that person that said, not how much money did you make today? What are we going to do about this? But just, hey, babe, oh, how'd it go? Okay, good. Do you think, what are we thinking for finances this week? This is what we can take to survive. Okay, great. I'm fine with that. So we communicate very well through this time. Instead of with my first wife, I was afraid to really communicate with her the ups and downs. Because if I said, hey, there's 50 grand in the account, hey, there's 5 grand in the account, most people can't live like that. You know what I mean? They're just like, where'd all the money go? Absolutely. And it's running a business.
This is such a great conversation for many reasons, but one of them is that I love bringing on someone who's had successes and some challenges and some failures, because that's the real road. The real road, the most beneficial changes that you make, I think, are usually based on a failure or a disappointment or a turn that you couldn't anticipate. Not only couldn't you anticipate, but you couldn't recover from easily. That makes you better the next round. And I really appreciate that you shared your knowledge about, if you're an entrepreneur, you will have failures. You are the risk takers in the world. These are my people. These are the people I love to coach. These are the people that excite me so much, that don't take the safe route. Sometimes they're a little bit crazy because they take on big things, but the truth is that's far more exciting. It's more exciting to get up during the day to go do something that you're not exactly sure how it's going to work out, but you got faith in yourself and what you've put together, and you'll adjust as you go. So what I'd like to ask you is, one of the major things you covered is choosing the right partner, and being in the wrong partner, the price you can pay for that. And how you would change that, how you adjust for the next time, and then how you got through all that and had total faith that you could recover any situation. I think people appreciate that level of resilience. Share what it was for you. What's your biggest lesson in that? And what's your biggest strategy for turning that around?
So my biggest lesson was really, honestly, I used to know, like, I know my strength is in product development, sales process development, sales team development. I can take a sales team from me to several people producing millions of dollars a year within a year or two. Like, I writing the scripts, creating the whole sales process from beginning to end, writing all the cold calling scripts, writing all the cadences for cold email, writing the cadences for LinkedIn relationship building. Like, I can do all that stuff. But coming into this situation with my team, like, the biggest lesson I had to learn was really just looking at partner selection. And I said this on my last podcast that I did, do not choose a business partner off of one lunch or one dinner meeting. Those are the types of mistakes I made. Is I chose business partners either based off of just peripheral knowledge. Like, your business partner is going to become closer to you probably than your spouse, at least for a while. And so if you're going to have a business partner, like, I've cried with these guys, I've went to dinner, we've talked hours, we've made plans. And I know this, at the end of the day, all business partnerships work while no money is being made. But the moment that there starts to be an influx of cash into the company, there starts to be a posturing amongst people who were there in the beginning to try to elbow out their place amongst credit and amongst money. And when you're in a partnership, you end up this like weird dynamic where you're both trying to. So that's why this time around, I was like, I am not having a business partner. I'm going to take three directors. I'm going to invest in the three. I've got my director of fulfillment. I've got my director of marketing. And then I've got my, eventually I'll have a director of sales. And so I'll have four because I also have a director of production. She does like the producing with the hosts and the shows and all of that. And so what I do now is instead of having a partner that I trust to do all of that, I went in, I spent a few weeks learning everything, learning all the different aspects, and then going, okay, I need some reports. What reports do I need? And then I just like, and now every Monday I meet with my directors. I'm like, okay, go down your reports. Okay, why is that number off? Okay, tell me about that client. Okay, how are we going to fix that? Have you tried this? And go through for about an hour with one person, then go through with an hour with another person, then go through with an hour with another person, and just bullet point 3-4 hours straight through the company, straight through the business. And then they take their action items, they write them all down. And then the next week they say, this is what you told us to cover and change last week. This is how we changed it. We sent it all to you. This is what we're having problems with. These are our reports. And so now I'm able to not have to do the fulfillment, but still have a hand in it and set the standard for fulfillment. Because like, for example, today I was like, hey, we had this happen in the meeting last week. What did we do with it? Oh, I emailed him that day. Okay, and what did you say? I said this. Okay, so when did you email the true answer? Oh, I emailed it just today. And I was like, guys, 24 minutes to answer an incoming problem, 24 hours to solve it. What don't we get about that? Every inquiry is answered in 24 minutes. Every problem is solved within 24 hours if it's physically possible. That is wow. Our standard. And when you're not following that standard, you're either telling me, A, I don't care what your standards are, or B, I can't keep up with your standards. Either one of those puts me in a position where I have to say, do I need to find somebody who can or will follow my standards? And then they're always, guess what? They shape it up. They figure it out. Whereas before, when you give that standard and you're like, here, this is the new standard, they're like, how do we do it? It's, I want you to figure out, like, if somebody comes in, who gets that email and who's going to respond? And then how are you going to make sure that something gets done within 24 hours or at least an update in 24 hours? This is what we've done so far. You'll have another thing in another day. We should not be waiting a week before we give a real answer to a question a client has. And so I always believe in putting the onus on them and saying, here's the standard. It's not my job to figure out how you make the standard. It's your job to figure out how you make it. And I know it's highly possible.
So let's look at this, because I think this situation is so powerful. I think what you're saying is so powerful because a lot of people have been through, if you haven't been through one, you've been through five partnership opportunities that have come up. I have two. I've been through it too, where it's very exciting on the front end. Everybody's excited about this new venture. We see all the
possibilities. So you make
money. It's, that's true. It makes money. And exactly how you described it, of what happens when it starts making money. But by the same token, when challenges come up, I have always felt personally that I want the challenges to come up because then I know who I'm in bed with, whether it's a marriage or it's a business partnership, for the reason that I want to know how we work through challenges that come up. Do we come together and figure it out together and we're good at strategizing and we're willing to try different solutions? Or am I with someone who points a finger the other way or ducks the issue or doesn't own their part? I want to get that up front. I want to know before I go any further, but you sometimes don't have that opportunity. So I always think you ought to be looking at having an exit strategy that you both discuss if or however many people are involved, is what's our exit strategy from this business under the following circumstances? And they're generalized, obviously. But what do you think about that?
So what I would suggest, if somebody said you have to have a partner, what I would do is I would find somebody that matches my qualifications, and then I would invite them to do a 3-hour project or 3-month project with me, because that will dovetail into what we're going to do together. So we can take this piece and place it on whatever business we're eventually going to do. So we're going to go, okay, I'll just take an example right now, like with my podcast network. We're in the process of launching two shows that are just my shows. One's called Building Authority Through Media. Bam. It's got like a 60s and 70s superhero theme. I'm the Bam Man, and we've got like backgrounds, and we're actually trying to use AI to turn it into a 60s and 70s style cartoon. So all of my guests, we're going to do 4 weeks of LinkedIn, and then this week will be like Susan, the superhero of LinkedIn, and like we're going to be the dynamic duo solving this problem of sameness, and because corporate like phrase we're using now is conquering sameness. And so with conquering sameness, how are we conquering sameness in the bio? How are we conquering sameness when we're engaging? And so each person will have two subjects that they'll deep dive on about, and I'll use like phraseology that has to do like superhero things like that. So anyway, my point is this. I would take that partner and I'd say, okay, I want you to work with me on these two podcasts that are internal podcasts. I'm not going to make you a full partner yet, but I want to work with you, see what you do, see what you set up. I'm going to do this part. You do this part, this fulfillment, building the audience, whatever it is that they're going to do, and work with them 3 months on it. And then sit down and say, how do we like working together? Because it's like right now we are marrying people by prearranged marriages. And whether you think prearranged marriages work or not, prearranged business marriages, I think, are a pretty dangerous scenario. Like I said, having a short-term project with that potential business owner or partner, I think that they're going to appreciate it. If they feel like they're trapping you, they're not going to like it, because then they're going to feel like you're going to discover who they really are. But if you say, I got this 3-month project that has to do with what we're going to do together, here's how we'll revenue split it, but I want to work together on this short-term project before we look at, it's just like dating, right? So you date, you go out for a date, and then you go out for a nicer date, and then third time you stay over stereotypically, and then you go on a weekend away together, right? And then you go on a vacation away together, and now the relationship is getting more and more serious. We do that for people that we're going to spend money with, but we don't do that with the very people that we're going to make all our money with.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. So now let's talk about what is really up for you right now that you are so committed to, and what's going so well, is the Legal Podcast Network. What is it that made you shift your thinking to take on that specific area in life? What was that about for you? That was the avenue that you chose.
So a couple different things. I've done a podcast. I had a podcast I did in Austin, Texas about food, music, life. I interviewed like musicians there, chefs, entrepreneurs. And it's just kind of what's cool in Austin. And I had a real, real good fun time with that. I had 4 camera crew, 2 sound people. We did it on site. I spent a bunch of money. We did 60 episodes and I spent 6 figures doing it. And I did that. I really enjoyed it. Great relationships out of it. Learned a lot out of it. Me as an entrepreneur, I always have a book of business ideas, whether it's just something that came to me, whether it's something I saw, I think I could do better, whatever it is. And a while back, attorneys with my old partnership started saying, hey, do you guys do podcasts? And I was like, no. I went to my partner. I was like, hey, dude, we should launch a podcast network. And he's, no, let's launch a answering service. And I was like, okay, whatever, dude, fine. Do your thing. I'll just keep selling. Then when it came time, my partner and me split up. I just opened up my notebook. And there's probably 50 to 100 ideas in there, probably at any given time, 20 to 30 viable businesses that I could literally just start with a website and on the following Monday, keep going. I think personally, that's a sign of a real entrepreneur. A real entrepreneur is, you could take away my money. You could take, just give me a computer and an internet connection and I'll make something happen and I'll build something. I had people asking me, hey, what do you think? Will you do this? Nothing happened. So then when my partner broke up with me in December, I was like, what do I want to do? And I was like, this podcast thing is perfect because I'm on this island in Belize. All my clients, like I have 30 people, but I have 15 in the States, 10 in Pakistan, 5 in the Philippines, I guess 1 in South Africa. So one of those is a little bit off. But anyway, the point is, like, I have this program and I'm like, I want to get back into podcasting, but I've worked with attorneys long enough to know that if we just set up like, hey, this is a podcasting service, come to us with your ideas, come to us with what you want, come to us with a host, come to us with your guests, and we'll put it all together, it would have failed. Because most businesses, what do they say? Like, the poor buy recreation, the middle class buy knowledge, the upper middle class, I forget, the middle class buy education, the upper middle class buy knowledge, and the truly rich buy time. And so if I can sell time and time savings, and that's how I built this whole product, then the attorney just needs to show up, talk about something they've always talked about, and then we take care of literally everything else from there. So we structured it where they sign up, and like I was training my guys yesterday, I was like, guys, everything is simple. Everything is easy. Everything is, we take care of that. Don't worry about it, because we do. So make them understand. Don't say you could have one podcast or two, but if you did, don't make it complicated and make it super simple. We do your podcast. You do once a month, twice a month, four times a month. If you do it once a month, you're going to have a post every day, and we need to meet with you 2 hours every 4 months. If you do it twice a month, we need to meet with you 2 hours every 2 months, and you're going to have two full posts a day and two full shows a month. And if you want a weekly show, you're going to have to meet with us 2 hours every month, half hour per episode. Keep it super simple for them. If they want to be aggressive, they'll give us 2 hours. If they want to be passive, they'll give us 2 hours every 4 months. And I just went into them and I was like, guys, just make this simple. Less is best. Keep it simple, stupid. And we just tell them, all we need, sign up. We need 45 minutes for you to sit down with our content director so that we can identify your ideal client profile. Tracy has been interviewing attorneys for over 10 years, interviewed over 1,000 of them for SEO content, for book content. So she's going to be able to take that session and draw out all of your content and questions that we need to ask for your ideal client. So if your ideal client is a high net worth individual in the Dallas market who's going through a divorce, we're going to speak to those issues in every session in one way or another. So it's about ease of use for the attorneys. But what we tell them is just show up, talk for an hour, talk for 2 hours. These are the same questions that you get all the time anyway. But now when somebody calls in, if they didn't find you through this, your receptionist could say, oh, you know what? The attorney has a great 3-minute video that he shot on that. Let me just send that to you. And then if you have any more questions, we'd be happy to work with you. Here's the calendar. You can schedule some time. And now the attorney isn't answering the same question he answers 5 times a day. It's saving him time. Plus, the people that are coming to him know and trust, which I think I saw in your intro of how you do things. With this sort of marketing, question-based marketing with authoritative positioning, the no and the like is already there. So when they call you, they just have to confirm that they can trust you. But they already do, because you're the one who's answered the questions that specifically have to deal with their issue. And so that's what we have tried to do with this product to make it successful, is we want attorneys to feel like, I just need to sit down and talk half hour to 2 hours here and there. That's it. They do all these posts. They do all this content. They do all these videos. They make these podcasts for me. And I just sit back and it's good to go.
It's pretty nice. And now a lot of attorneys are extremely interesting and stimulating. And then there's the dry end that are not so interesting to listen to. And do you help them with their content in order to be more presentable on the stage, or do you have anything to do with training?
So we'll try to do a little bit of training. Really, we depend on our hosts who have been doing this a long time to really try to bring out the best in that attorney. So we really depend on our hosts, because they all have 5-10 years plus of hosting experience in podcasting. If you're doing shows, you get somebody on that's just, you're just like, wow, how am I going to get a show out of this guy or this girl, right? Whereas like when I came on, you were like, this is going to be easy. Do I even have to talk? You don't shut up, dude. So it's the same thing with our clients. So what we try to do is we try to focus not on the quality of the delivery, but of the quality of the content. So Maybe you might not want to listen to them for 20 minutes, but you might listen to a 3 to 5 minute video that answers a very specific question that they answer knowledgeably, even if they're a bit monotone. Or you'll watch a 1 minute video with them giving some nuggets. Then you'll go to their website and you'll read their FAQ pages and watch a 1 minute here, 3 minutes there. People don't care if their attorney is entertaining. They want to know that their attorney is capable for their very specific issue. So if it's a monotone delivery, that's okay, because we're not trying to get an hour and a half listen. This isn't a Joe Rogan sit around, laugh, and make stuff up. This is very pointed content that has to do with their specific situation. And so while, yes, we try, like some attorneys bring on other attorneys and have great conversations, at the end of the day, if this is a show for their end user, they could be boring all they want, because that's not the point. The point is expertise, not excitement. And so that's why
I will, let me interject something in here that it made me think of when you were saying that, is that there, and then you will find the people that are end up being stars that you would not have anticipated. And while that's great, if you have a great host, the job of the host is to make it an interesting show and be able to pull out from that guest
exactly
what will make it intriguing, interesting, engaging content that listeners will stay on board. Absolutely agree.
Right.
Like I said, in 1 minute in with Dennis, I knew this would be the easiest interview, because you can do it by yourself. You're so well set up to do that. But I was thinking, there are some stars that have been made lately in the legal side of things that are, they're now superstars. One of them I was thinking about, there was a celebrity trial that went on. You had several of these podcasters who jumped on board. It was a Johnny Depp, Amber Heard. And I bring that up because I remember that there was a guy on there, Emily Baker was one, but also Peter Tragos. And he was a, what do you call it? What kind of attorney is he? If you get hit and run type of
okay.
guy.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, personal injury.
Superstar, because his delivery was so fair, honest, unbiased. And you just got attached to them. Brian Friedman right now is another one who's getting so much attention online just because of a high profile. So sometimes you get those stars that really.
And that's true. We do have a couple of those already. It's really been just fortuitous timing. We had two clients, one guy who came on beginning of the year, and he focuses on FDA imports. Talk about timely launching of your podcast. And then another guy who, I think it was January as well, he launched a show about federal employees unemployment filing.
Oh my gosh. Could you imagine?
And like both of them are just like, we just launched our podcast and it just, everybody from everywhere started calling us. And I was like, I wish it was that easy for everybody. You have a very specialized nationwide niche that no one else is talking about in YouTube and in the algorithm. So they just jumped right up to answer the questions. So we have those stars. We have people like that. But for us, it's not, because there's really three types of shows for our clients. And most of them will do the first one, which is an authority building show. It's about them positioning themselves as the go-to for a certain ideal case type or client type in their marketplace. So I'm a criminal defense lawyer, but I want sex crimes and murders. I want the worst of the worst felonies. So all my marketing's about that, right? But then he might not necessarily have the type of volume that our other clients have. But every time with 50 people watch his show and 10 people call him and 3 people hire him, that's way more, because on a felony level, it's 30 to 50 grand just for the retainer. And it's usually 400 to 500 an hour after the retainer's gone. So you think about that. And like, I talk to attorneys, because I'll have attorneys ask me all the time, can you help me go viral? And I'm just like, why would you want to go viral? So I can reach more clients. And I was like, so you think there's 1 million people in your marketplace that have a need of your service that are going to watch this video and then respond to it? No. If you want to go viral, learn how to ride a unicycle, juggle law books, and right off the end of the Santa Monica Pier, I'll video. Listen, if you want to do it, I'll even jump on a plane and come video for it for you. But here's what's going to happen. You're going to upload that video. Let's say you get 2 million YouTube views. Do you know how much money you just made? I want to say it's $4,000. I think it's 2,000 per million right now. They're one of the higher ones. So let's say it's $4,000, and maybe I'm a little high on the numbers, but you got 2 million people to see your video and you got $4,000 out of it. Now, if you get one client at like 50,000 retainer and they go all the way to trial and you make 120 grand, let's say you got three clients off of it. One doesn't go to trial, settles, you make 10 grand off of it, but all together you make 150 grand. Which one is more valuable to your firm?
Well, you know what they say, you can't market to everybody. If you market to everyone, you market to no one. But it's interesting that you offer exclusivity with your podcast. So what you, one attorney per niche, per region?
What? Correct. And that's just because I think it's disingenuous. If I take, for example, David Schwenke, he's one of our older clients. He's a Chicagoland criminal defense attorney. I think if it's disingenuous, if I say, hey, David, I'm going to make you the preeminent criminal defense attorney in Cook County, and then I hire two, or then I work with two of his competitors in a similar program, although the content would technically be different. Like, to me, that's disingenuous to say to him, I'm going to make you an expert and help you stand out, but then I'm going to work with two of your competitors. So yeah. There are 250 markets in the United States with 250,000 people or more, and we have about 12 types of attorneys. And that's just standard. Like, we get a lot of, like I talked to you, that guy with the federal employees or FDA, like we get a lot of very niche practices, but we also get just, there's 2,500 plus slots, if you will, for us to sell and bring on clients just in legal. And then I also own the medical podcast network. I also own the professional podcast network. So once we have all of our systems down, we'll probably go into professional, talk to realtors, mortgage, insurance, title companies, whatever, and show them the program. Because we already have them contacting us and saying, hey, when are you guys doing this for us? And we're like, we could technically do it now, but we don't really have a place to place your marketing. So, yeah, I mean, we're just going to keep right on moving forward with it.
That's so exciting. That's really exciting. From your perspective, what do you think are the biggest content mistakes that you see legal professionals make? Like, how do you help them shift out of their autopilot mode? What's your solution to that?
We do it for them. We build the content. We post it for them. The best way to do it is to have somebody who knows what they're doing it for you. But the biggest mistake that I make, that I see, is two things. One is inconsistency. The algorithms hate it when you're inconsistent. And everybody thinks, if I just post on my Facebook page once a week and Instagram every 3 months and my LinkedIn once a quarter, like, that is not sufficient for the algorithms to give you any sort of love. So number one is pure, it's just inconsistency. The second mistake I see them make is their content is very much just, hey, me. Because even like with our podcast stuff, we're like, hey, learn about this, go here and do that. Whereas it's usually just got honored with the Johnson County Criminal Defense Attorney of the Year, everybody. And it's just, everybody's like, exactly. So that's, most people think of social media as an announcement engine. And social media is not, especially business owners, they think of it as, this is where we make announcements. It's like a bulletin board for the world. And it's not where you make announcements. It's where you have engagement. It's where you put out stuff that people that might want to use you can see it and go, oh, wow, that helps. And then when they respond, going back to them, say, hey, we're glad it could help to you. I just sent you something in the inbox to follow up with it, see if it could be of even more help. That's what social media is. It is having social interactions through the internet. But most attorneys just see it as like a bulletin board to post up their stuff and step away from.
That is really good advice. And I hope everybody's heard that. There's really nothing more important right now in how to perceive social media and what it can do for you instead of just empty posting. Nobody cares. Those awards, they're for you. Nobody's really looking at that. So this is really helpful. Looking back on all the things that you've done, I would like to ask you, what do you feel? Talk about someone who's been around the world and back and now lives in Belize. That's a nice way to end up. I'd like to know, tell me something that you are really proud of. What's the thing that really makes you most proud of all these ventures and all these accomplishments that you've had?
I think the thing I'm most proud of is my relationships with my family, with my children, with my nephews, because a lot of people in their pursuit of money have seen it as I must kind of push everything else out. Whereas with me in earning money, I've always seen it as a way to build bridges, do things for people, help people, empower people, take them out of situations, things like that. So for me, my proudest thing is I've got a 25-year-old, a 23-year-old, and a 19-year-old who, when the divorce happened, there was a few years where I didn't have the greatest relationship. And without me pushing just a couple times a year for a few years saying, hey, I know it's your birthday. I love you. Hopefully I'm not unblocked. And just planting those seeds over and over to where now they're all three in my life. I text with them on a regular basis a couple times a week. My nephews, who my sister lost her husband 7-8 years ago. And when she lost her husband, she had a 6-year-old, a 4-year-old, and she was pregnant. And I would go up there and I would spend like a weekend all week into the next weekend because I've been remote for a long time. So I just go up there, get a little Airbnb nearby, work, go to dinner, go to their basketball games, just spend the whole week with the boys and develop the name Uncle Awesome, the moniker from that, just being just like that step in dad. So what I'm most proud of are the relationships in my life and the way that I've been able to take a family that was on the bottom rung socioeconomically, and at least for me and mine, I've taken us up a few rungs and provided opportunities that I never had. I help all three of my kids get started out in life with money and jobs and paying bills for a while. And listen, like I told you, I got $20 to start my life on. So it's things like that, what I can do for the people I care most about because of this, that I'm the most proud of.
Ah, there is no place better to end this particular interview with, because what is most important in the end is the impact you make with those people that you love the most and who you come into this world with. And I think that's beautiful. So I just, Dennis, this is the perfect place to stop. I just want to thank you for jumping on the mic today and pulling back the curtain on all this. This was so valuable. I would love it if you would come back again. There is a whole nother world we need to explore that we didn't even get a chance to get to. So part B is coming. Would you come back again?
Absolutely. Just send me an email. I'll send you back my calendar. And I'm always happy to come back on. We can even do it relatively close so that they can release together if that helps you. But yeah, I got a whole slew of things to talk about. I've been running remote teams since early 2000. So I have that. I've been in marketing. I've done social media. I've lived in the algorithms for years. There's marketing geeky stuff I can talk about. There's life stuff I can talk about. There's what we see in the future for this sort of like business and the way business is going. I got all kinds of opinions. Just bring me back. I'll be happy to give you any of them.
I love it. Plan on it. We're going to get together next time. We're going to talk about the ins, the outs, the ups, the downs, and how to successfully produce podcasts, how to use podcasts for your business, how to set yourself up. There are so many wonderful ways now that you have affordable ways of doing things. I'm going to bring you back to have that conversation because you are so well-versed in it. And we started our conversation before. Let's continue this. I will reach out to you. A couple of things that stand out is this is a reminder to lawyers out there. You don't have to be a tech guru. You just need to show up, speak up, and let Dennis's system like yours handle the rest. And also that look at your podcast. It's not just content. It really is a trust-building, client-attracting machine when it's done right. And if you want to learn more
about... because we're taking care of social, we're taking care of website content, we're putting on 25 outlets. It's a very holistic approach. We're not just saying, hey, we did your podcast, good luck with it. We really, because what we learned after a year is our clients don't put enough content out there to really support something like a podcast getting extra views from their social. So now we're like, okay, we're going to do all your social, 1, 2, or 3 posts a day. The other thing that we learned was communication. We weren't communicating well with our clients. So every Monday they get a 5 points. Here's your, when your next podcast is going out. Here's your here's what's going out this week on your content. Here's what you need to approve for content. Here's when we need you to shoot your next podcast. And then here's your stats from the last 30 days from all of your shows. So we just give it to them Monday morning, 15 minutes. They know exactly what's going on with the program.
boils down to you make it easy. And for everybody out there listening, if you want to learn more about Dennis and the Legal Podcast Network, head over to thelegalpodcastnetwork.com. Very simple,
yes,
whether you're an attorney and you're looking to step out of the shadows, or really if you're a professional that wants to elevate your voice, his platform is just a masterclass in making public speaking feel doable and repeatable and powerful. He's really helping people go from invisible to undeniable. And that's exactly what we're about here too. If this conversation lit a fire under you and you want to find out more, don't keep it to yourself. Like this, share it. There may be people that really need to hear this episode, and I love hearing your thoughts. Really helps us keep the spotlight on the voices that matter the most. So remember, speaking up, it's just not good for business. It's how you shift the room, you shape your reputation, and you show the world what you're really made of. So thank you again, Dennis, and everyone
Absolutely.
Out there for being here today. And as always, I look forward to our next conversation, and we'll see you next time. Dennis, I'll be in touch for part B.
Sounds good.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight. We hope you enjoyed this deep dive once again into the remarkable stories and insights of our incredible guests. Their experiences and hard-earned, time-tested wisdom are not just meant to inspire you, but to provide you with actionable steps to take on your own path to success. Remember, you have a story to tell, and your voice has the power to transform your business and make lasting impact. And that's what it's all about. If you found value in today's episode, let us know. And I hope you'll take a moment and subscribe to The Spotlight wherever you listen to your podcasts, so you never miss a thought-provoking or idea-producing conversation. I'm Kelly O'Hara, and I can't wait to see you back here for the next episode of the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight.